Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 27, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm coming to you on recording tonight because I'm off celebrating the holiday, but I've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, an interview recorded a couple of days ago with the writer Joel Shalit about the issue of anti-Semitism and the left, in particular, a reaction to the new volume from Counterpunch, edited by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, called The Politics of Anti-Semitism. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Patrick Mason, an economist who teaches at Florida State University, about the economics of discrimination, specifically racial discrimination in the job market in terms of employment and pay. This is a rerun of an interview that ran on this program in June. And I apologize for the reruns, but I've been running around the country promoting my new book, and I've been a little challenged at putting together this radio show, and I thought Patrick's interview was fit nicely with the Joel Shalit interview together to form a kind of Thanksgiving package on bigotry and discrimination. Because these last week's program and this week's as well has been coming on, was on recording, I hadn't had quite the opportunity to analyze the economic headlines that I would like. There's a little bit too much prescience involved for me to forecast headlines before the fact, but I would make a couple of general observations that most of the economic numbers that have been coming out over the last several weeks have been surprises to the upside. That is, stronger than anyone expected, or at least stronger than the kinds of people who follow these things expected. So it does indeed seem like the U.S. economy is on a recovery swing. This is the opposite of what we saw earlier in the year when most of the surprises were to the downside this time, and that was, of course, as the economy persisted in its failure to recover. But now I think we're seeing something of a more solid acceleration, at least. And certainly the numbers on gross domestic product, the revision of the initial report of the third quarter, revised up a full point to growth of over 8% at an annual rate. It's a very strong number, very impressive. It was across the board. It wasn't just dominated by military spending as the report for the second quarter was. So it does seem like the U.S. economy is certainly on an upswing. We're certainly not going to see that kind of 8% growth rate for the quarters to come. we're more likely to see something in the 4% range. But this is looking more and more like an ordinary economic recovery. Now, one area where it does not, or has not at least, been looking like an ordinary recovery is in the job market. We've seen positive employment growth for the last several months, but at a rate much slower than we would see in a normal month, and certainly much slower than at the rate we would see in early in economic recoveries. Usually, you see growth rates of 300,000 or 400,000 in early in economic recoveries. In the normal month, we'd see 200 or 250,000 new jobs, and over the last several months, we've averaged only about half that. So it's still pretty slow, and we're also seeing very poor wage performance. The average real wage, that is the wage corrected for inflation now, has turned to zero. That is, there's no growth in real wages. And the main reason for that is it seems that the new jobs that are being created over the last several months are mostly in low-wage sectors, in retail, in food service, in the low-paying healthcare jobs, and that is dragging down the average. So in a lot of ways, this is looking like the 1980s expansion more than the 1990s expansion. In the 1990s, we saw some real wage gains across the board. Now we're not seeing that. Now, of course, anything can happen. Anything may change, but we're not seeing a very impressive or broad-based recovery in the job market. So still, a big split between the kinds of headline numbers like GNP or GDP rather, and the actual numbers that matter to real people, the job and income numbers. So we'll see if this persists. We'll get employment numbers for November a week from Friday, and I will be reporting on those. And a couple of other, a little self-promotional note. I will be appearing at Blue Stockings Bookstore on Allen Street on December 4th at 7 p.m., and also along with Bob Polin at the economist Bob Polin, who will be my guest on December 11th on this show. Bob and I will be talking about our books. He has Contours of Dissent just out from Verso, his look at the 1990s economy, and I will be talking about my own new book, After the New Economy, at the Brecht Forum on 122 West 27th Street. That's on December 11th at 7:30 p.m. And now let's turn to an interview I recorded earlier this week when I was out in San Francisco promoting my book on the West Coast. With Joel Shalit. Joel is a student of politics and a writer. He's got three books to his name, and the most recently, Jerusalem Calling, published by Akashic Books, a political memoir of growing up in Israel and the United States. And he's also got a book coming out from Akashic sometime next year on Israel and the Left. Joel is both very critical of Israeli policy, of religious nationalism of all kinds, but he's also very wary of the kinds of rhetoric that some of the critics of Israel and religious nationalism use. And while I was out west, I bought a copy of a little book edited by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, The Politics of Anti-Semitism, published by AK Press. And it's a collection of things that have appeared in the newsletter Counterpunch or on their website. And I found it a very, very disturbing book. It seemed to dismiss any idea that Israel serves the imperial purposes of the United States and looked instead to ascribe U.S. support for Israel, both military and financial, to a cabal of Zionist conspirators. And that just sounded way too much like traditional anti-Semitic language. It also didn't comport at all with what I understand how the United States works and how its foreign policy works. It seemed very unlikely that a small group of people, however well-financed, could hijack American military and political policy for their own ends. And so I thought, since I was in San Francisco and actually staying with Joel, who's a friend of mine, I should, in full disclosure, that I thought it would be a good opportunity with him to do this kind of audio review of the collection. So here is Joel Shalit. Joel, we learn in a new collection from the people at Counterpunch that anti-Semitism isn't a particular problem on either the U.S. or the world left. What do you think of this diagnosis?
I think it's absolutely incorrect. Mm-hmm. There's no truth to it whatsoever. And the collection that you refer to, The Politics of Anti-Semitism, is really more valuable for reviewing what the left thinks about anti-Semitism today, particularly in North America, more than it is an accurate sociological reading of anti-Semitism as an ideology that's subscribed to and promulgated by Zionists and conservative Jews in order to mystify and legitimate American and American Jewish support for Israeli foreign policy in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Let's take that piece by piece. First of all, several of the contributors argue that anti-Semitism isn't really a serious problem, either in the U.S. or pretty much anywhere in the world, and that it's essentially an invention of apologists for Israeli brutality, that if it exists at all, it's just kind of a feeling, but not something that is has been translated into any kind of political action. What do you think?
I think they're correct on a certain level. I mean, that's the problem, is that anti-Semitism is an ideology used to justify, it is an apologetic strategy used to justify Israeli brutality in its military conduct in the occupied territories. Unfortunately, the way that, if you look at the history of Zionist discourse about anti-Semitism, particularly since the beginning of the occupation in 1967, there has been a profound and continuous narrative linkage of anti-Semitism with critiques of Israeli state policy, right down the line. So to a large degree, I believe it is true that this connection, which feeds anti-Semitic and neo-anti-Semitic discourses on both the right and the left, is fed by the way in which Israelis and conservative American Jews have historically linked anti-Semitism with criticism of Israeli policy.
And also, several contributors to this volume make the argument that Jews occupy positions of great power and wealth in the United States, and that they should not be viewed as a victimized or potentially abused population, but in fact one of the victimizers and abusers. How should we think about the social position of Jews in the U.S. in that light?
We are a privileged I will identify myself as a Jew, of course, and the recipient of a great education, and I possess all of the quote-unquote aristocratic trappings that are ascribed to Jews in this particular collection of essays by most of the authors. That said, I think Jews do continue to live with a certain degree of discrimination, more on a cultural level than on a structural level. There is no systematic political discrimination against Jews in the United States anymore. This is a thing of the past. That said, Jews do occupy certain privileged spaces in American politics and in American culture. It's very difficult to avoid imagery of Jews as integrated, fully functioning persons on television, Seinfeld, for example. It's hard to not encounter a Jewish presence, an explicit Jewish presence, in most aspects of American popular culture. And certainly, there is a profound and extremely overt presence of Jews in American political life in both the Republican and Democratic parties. For example, Ari Fleischer, the former spokesperson for Bush. Could you ask for not only a more Jewish name, but a more classically post-war Israeli-identified Jewish name than Ari? You know, that's not exactly what you would call a typical diaspora Jewish name like Joseph. It's explicitly Israelicized. So these are the facts. Does this mean that Jews participate in the same discriminatory structures that are typical of American aristocratic class politics? Yes, they do. This does not, however, mean that they deserve to be singled out in the manner that the left certain portions, certain segments of the left in this country have begun to single them out in the post September 11th political environment. And unfortunately, you know, when you go to demonstrations organized by International Answer against the war, against the occupation of Palestine, etc., you hear the term Jews referred to more than Israelis. This cannot help but develop a peculiar kind of contemporary progressive racism, which is undeserved. And it does reveal...
But it's a racism that takes the disguise of anti-racism.
That's correct. And in that sense, it's entirely deceptive, and must be watched out for with a great degree of vigilance, because not only should it be objected to on the grounds that it is indeed a racist discourse, which cannot be tolerated, but it also is kind of like a gateway racism, you know, which will open the floodgates for the tolerance of the practice of racism within the left to groups other than Jews in the future.
People also point, for example, to you know, Jewish control of the media, and there is some sociological basis for this perception. You know,
yes.
The New York Times, Hollywood, some of the networks and such.
Yeah.
How do we think about that issue?
That's a really hard question. I mean, again, you have to critique racism wherever it is practiced, even if it has some kind of sociological validity not in terms of its practice, but in terms of what it identifies as ownership of private property, of media property. You know, unfortunately, the entire world has moved to the right in the last, since the end of the Vietnam War, really. And it's impossible to dissociate Jews from that cultural trend towards right-wing conservative thinking and politics, and certainly the high degree of Jewish media ownership, both in Hollywood and in the print world, makes it very easy for progressives to critique the ethnicity of their ownership of these media outlets, which are increasingly propagandistic and serve the interests of the American state. Again, progressives have to be a little more high-minded than singling out the sheer fact of the ethnicity of the ownership of these media outlets as the root cause of their reactionary politics and their propagandistic politics. And it's incredibly tragic that the level of critical imagination on the part of the American left and on the part of American progressive communities, that they reduce the politics of these media outlets to the ethnicity of their owners to be the case. It bespeaks, in my opinion, a hollowness to their progressivism that ought to be seriously debated and considered in left-wing circles in this country. Unfortunately, I think September 11th, and even prior to that, the advent of the new quote-unquote, you know, anti-capitalist movement in Seattle in November 1999 has helped in the 13 years since the end of the Cold War, which really should be dated starting 1991 rather than 1989, it's opened the doors to a reinvigoration of traditional left ideological constellations such as that which prevailed under the Orthodox Marxist parties.
Well, you face September 11th, and it seems that some people on the left have responded to the targeting of Islamic terrorism by saying somehow the Israelis were complicit, or they knew, or there's some kind of Israeli responsibility for blowing up the World Trade Center and similar things. What do you think of that?
The Amiri Baraka alibi, as people, you know, for those who don't remember, you know, a very prevalent conspiracy theory espoused most popularly in the press by Amiri Baraka's poem about Israelis who left the World Trade Center.
4,000 of them.
Yeah, who never showed up for work that day. I don't know how to explain that other than to say that how does one put this? In looking for an explanation for the September 11th bombings or attacks on the United States, there has been a tendency to react to American political scapegoating of persons of Islamic descent in the 2 years or 3 years since that date, almost 3 years since then, with a scapegoating of Jews on the left. In the same sense that the American state has vilified and victimized persons of Islamic descent for these attacks, the left in turn has increasingly blamed Jews and Israelis for creating the environment and to a certain extent abetting the prosecution of these attacks. And it's there is an empirical basis for it in terms of arguing that it's impossible to consider an American confrontation with Islamic revolutionaries without its relationship with Israel and without Israel, without the practice of brutality in the occupied territories of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that America funds and supports. But it's incredibly specious to say that the Mossad, therefore, staged these attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon using Arab, dupes that it recruited and trained. Again, resorting to conspiracy theory to explain why these events happened inevitably leads to the scapegoating of minorities who have a very tendentious relationship to these events, other than their ethnic background and their sentimentality for a Jewish nationalist project in the Middle East.
There's no denying that U.S. support of Israel has inflamed a lot of Arab and Islamic resentment of this country and anger against it. On the other hand, there are people, some of the contributors to this Counterpunch volume argue that, contrary to the analysis of Noam Chomsky and others, that that Israel serves U.S. Imperial purposes, that in fact the U.S. Support of Israel is manipulated by Israel and American Jews, and that it really doesn't serve U.S. national interests, that this is kind of Congress is Israeli-occupied territory, is one cliche, that sort of argument, that it's really this Zionist cabal that controls U.S. policy rather than U.S. policy support for Israel being promoting U.S. foreign policy interests, and particularly the current gang around the Bush administration, Wolfowitz and the other neocons, who are indeed quite friendly to the Likud party.
Sure.
Is this they have some kind of primary loyalty to Israel that causes them to act this way, or is this really Israel fit into their worldview?
I think that as far as the Counterpunch volume is concerned, your analysis of their position is essentially correct. The contention in the politics of anti-Semitism, the shared contention amongst the American contributors to the volume in particular, is that Israelis manipulate American support for their state and for their military policies and are not, spiritually in sync with their American patrons. They take what they can get from the United States, and if America chooses to disagree with Israeli military conduct and Israeli foreign policy, the Israelis are simply ready to abandon them and move on and find a new patron state to support their activities. Unfortunately, it's a little more nuanced. The situation is a little more nuanced than that. The Israelis historically have been very desirous of foreign financial and military support, and also very suspicious of the constraints that their dependency relationship on the United States, and prior to that, the French, has imposed on their ability to act independently. They want the Israeli military and the Israeli government wants to be able to protect quote-unquote Israeli and Jewish interests independent of its the interests of its sponsors. In the case of the United States, their interests tend to coincide more than not. American political interests in the Middle East and Israeli political interests in the Middle East more often than not are the same. And I think that the argument made in the Counterpunch volume is essentially that the Jews who serve in the American government, in the Bush administration, the diplomatic corps career functionaries who are also Jews, are have competing national loyalties, and that they will always privilege their loyalties to Israel by virtue of their ethnicity over their necessary loyalties to the United States. This is one of the horrible problems with this book, that it would make such allegations, that, you know, Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz would inevitably sacrifice American interests as American government officials and representatives in favor of advancing Israeli interests in the Middle East. So the occupation of Iraq in such a worldview, as obviously deleterious as it is to the United States and as obviously financially draining and unnecessarily brutal both to Iraqi civilians and American troops serving in the region, is insisted on by Jewish American government officials because it serves the greater interests of Israel over the United States. These kind of arguments can't be tolerated. And it is absolutely amazing that at this stage of the game, at this stage of history, both in the history of, well, it's particularly for the history of the left and its consideration of issues of multiculturalism in North America since the end of the Second World War, that there would be a climate that could even encourage this kind of discourse about Jewish conspiracy. And it obviously shows that the years since the civil rights movement in this country have done little to cleanse the American left of its lingering racism towards non-obvious representatives of ethnic difference within its ranks. Jews have always been a very special case in terms of the history of Western racism. They are what Max Horkheimer, the former Frankfurt School member, called outsiders within the bourgeoisie. They may achieve levels of economic integration and political equality, but they're still bearers of a certain kind of cultural difference, which leaves them susceptible to historical forms of discrimination, racist discrimination. And Asian Americans, to a certain extent, suffer the same stigma. Look at what happened to that Chinese American nuclear scientist. What was his name?
Wen Ho Lee.
It was the same drill. He was like, he was a contemporary American, sort of Asian American, you know, Dreyfus. And so I think that a book like The Politics of Anti-Semitism and the absolutely ludicrous positions taken by Alexander Coburn in this book, and to a certain extent Jeffrey St. Clair too, all due respect to their journalistic work in other areas, has for the first time, and this is why this book is such a tremendous cultural event, for the first time, firmly collected in the space of one book, all of the contradictory positions on racism that have developed within the American left since the end of the Vietnam War, using to, you know, we could look at it this way in sort of a laboratory setting, using the new Jewish question as their subject matter. I'm distressed by it. I think it's important that progressives ought to very seriously examine what it is the authors in this collection have to say as being representative of what the left community in the United States, outside of specifically Jewish circles, thinks about anti-Jewish racism.
And finally, is it possible to be critical of, you know, Israeli policy and even the kind of ethno-religiously defined nature of Israeli citizenship, which is a very strange thing, nothing like it anywhere else in the world, really, at the same time without falling into old-fashioned anti-Semitism or newfangled anti-Semitism? Can one do both things at once?
Sure. I mean, Judith Butler wrote a terrific essay for the London Review of Books this summer, in which she attempted to defend the academic boycott, among other things, of Israeli scholars. And while I disagree with a lot of her positions in the article, one of the things Judith Butler drove home beautifully was she identified the fact that there is an Israeli progressive intellectual community that ought to be supported in helping overturn the current status quo in Israel in regards to the Sharon government. And her point was essentially that the left tends to devolve its critique of Israeli government policy into anti-Semitic discourses precisely because it doesn't know how to distinguish between the state and individuals in Israel. In other words, the left anti-Semitism in regards to left-wing critiques of Israel tends to see Israel as a sort of a total, Israeli society as a totality in which the state, the military, and individual opinions are essentially a closed circle, and that there's a unity of opinion. There is a consensus. There's an unbreakable consensus that characterizes Israeli politics, which is absolutely untrue, and that progressives need to be able to separate individuals from the state. And on that basis, they might be able to start dismantling their tendency to generalize what they would ascribe to be an inherent racism towards Arabs from Jewish culture that they identify with Israel.
All right, thanks, Joel. And that was Joel Shalit in an interview I recorded earlier this week. Joel is the author most recently of a book called Jerusalem Calling, a collection of essays on growing up in Israel and in the United States. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And please give us, remember, we are in dire need of your support. So if you've made a pledge, please make good on your pledge. If you haven't made a pledge, send us a check or visit our website and make a pledge. We need your money because without your support, without your financial support, this radio station couldn't exist much longer. So please be generous and help us out. And let's take this musical break, the Prelude number 7 for piano by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. And that was the prelude number 7 in the A major for piano by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. And now an interview I first ran in this program on June 19th of this year with Patrick Mason, who is one of our leading experts on the economics of racial discrimination. Patrick teaches at Florida State University, and I thought I'd ask him to just give us a general look at the field. There's a lot of conventional argument that racial discrimination in pay and employment is a thing of the past. Patrick Mason. So, I was reading a statement by George Gilder recently, who claimed that after adjusting for education and experience and IQ, black Americans are overpaid relative to whites. George Gilder has a unique outlook on the world. But what's your research telling you about the state of pay discrimination these days?
Well, quite different from Mr. Gelder. I mean, even from the issue of how one goes about measuring things like IQ. But, I mean, when you make those kinds of adjustments, when you adjust for a supposed difference in things that are linked with productivity, there was some degree of progress made from the mid-60s, but then that stopped in the mid-70s, and we've sort of had not much change since. And in some instances, maybe some deterioration in the amount of measured discrimination.
Well, how do you go about measuring discrimination?
Well, you try and get you try and say, okay, suppose these two different groups of workers, blacks and whites, are identical. And so basically what you do is try and compare apples to apples by looking, say, at men, and then there might be a racial gap in pay on the order of about 30%. And you ask yourself, well, how much of that racial difference in pay is due to education? How much of it is due to experience? How much of it is due to different living in different regions of the country, et cetera? And generally what's left, if we in fact are able to account for everything that might influence productivity on the job, then what's left we usually assume is discrimination.
And what are the results of these kinds of exercises that you've come up with?
Depending on which region of the country you're looking at, that, for example, outside of the South, if you're looking at men, there's about a 17% pay differential. Within the South, if you're looking at men, it's about 22% in terms of difference in earnings after accounting for things like education, experience, et cetera.
And now this is a standard thing that economists do. They try to like render groups equal by adjusting for things like education and experience,
right,
and such like. So there's a little bit of statistical magic in it, but it's still a pretty straightforward
statistic. And then even what economists mean by discrimination is kind of tricky, because the exercise that I just gave you is an attempt to account for the extent of discrimination within the labor market. It does not account for discrimination in things like access to education, right? Things that are outside of the labor market.
Yeah, so I guess these are sometimes called like pre-market discrimination.
Pre-market discrimination or extra-market discrimination or some such label along those lines.
So, but even after accounting, let's just set that aside for the moment. But even if you try to set, black group equal to white group, mm-hmm, using all the statistical work, the residual of discrimination is on the order of 15% to 20%.
Yes.
Now, you've also, some years ago, I heard you give a paper on education, which is very interesting, that actually black families have outperformed statistical expectations over the years. Could you talk about that education angle a bit?
Oh, yeah. That was looking at differences in acquired years of education, where we try to do the same sort of exercise and say, okay, what factors might influence levels of educational attainment? Perhaps the background of mothers or fathers, the region of the country. In other words, what kind of resources that are available to individuals, and then look at how they actually perform. And when you do that, what you find is that if you take a statistically identical African-American, statistically identical white, that actual years of education for the African-American would be slightly higher than the actual years of education for the white person coming from a statistically identical background. I mean, it's not extremely large, but the interesting thing is that, there is, if you will, a positive race effect, that African-Americans are able to translate a given level of resources into a slightly higher level of years of education. And that's interesting because one of the common assumptions is, say, people who are trying to explain labor market discrimination, the argument that their residual that's there is there because, well, there's something negative about African-American culture when it comes to work practices. Well, that's hard to reconcile with the positive residual when it comes to years of educational attainment, right? That in point of fact, that there may be something cultural among African-Americans to lead to a slightly higher level of education for a given amount of resources, and one would assume that that carries over into the labor market.
And this is a long-standing historical trend, right, going back to the mid-19th century?
Yeah, that's a pretty long-standing historical trend of African-Americans making up grounds relative to whites, where the white level of education was rising, and so too for African-Americans. And not only in terms of years of education, but even in terms of things like scores on standardized test scores. I mean, on average, the African-American performance is lower than for whites, but, say, in standardized test scores, things like the National Assessment of Educational Progress or even SAT scores, but that gap has been closing for at least 30 years.
Now, economists who defend the status quo often talk about, you know, unobserved characteristics that employers, in their great wisdom and, of course, great fairness, see things about employers that you can't capture in the kinds of models you're talking about. And really, that's not discrimination, but actually a fair reflection of lower performance. What's your reaction to that kind of claim?
Well, I mean, that's usually the argument that's forward by some people who I think wish to defend the status quo. But I don't think that the data that we look at will actually support that claim, in the sense that the issue that I just raised about the difference in translating class or family resources into years of education. Also, looking at the trend, if you will, over the long term in terms of things like gains made both in the quantity and quality of education, there's been enormous decreases in the racial gap in those areas, and it hasn't been matched by a similar decrease in the wage payment in the market. And not only that, but when you look at different regions of the country, you observe patterns that are kind of worrisome. For example, if you look outside of the South, roughly a little bit over half of all African Americans live in the South, and roughly one half live outside of the South. And for African American men outside of the South, for example, there's a larger racial wage residual. Than in the 80s or the 70s, unlike the South, where there has been
We had a little glitch there. So you're saying that the recent wage differential, what we would say the effect of discrimination, has gotten worse?
Outside of the South. And, in fact, that's been a continuation of a pattern that started in the mid-70s, and it's gotten worse. Right, that residual outside of the South was on the order of 11% in the late 70s. It's on the order of 17% now, or slightly higher.
So
within the South, there's been some decline during the 90s.
Well, what happened? I mean, you said there was some progress in the 60s, early 70s that came to a halt, and in some regions it's gotten worse in recent years. What's responsible for this change?
I think there are a mixture of things. One, the terrible series of recessions. Recessions, of course, have a negative impact on all groups of workers, but a particularly negative impact on African Americans. And we had three very bad recessions, and we're currently in a recession, which every time a recession comes along, it sort of it will undo a lot of progress that was made in previous years. The next thing is a change in federal policy, in particular both the enforcement of anti-discrimination laws and the enforcement of affirmative action in federal government contracting. And the third factor that I think that has had an effect has been the decline of industries in the Midwest. African Americans, and especially men, were very heavily located in the old automobile industry. And if you look at the industries that have done badly over the last couple of decades, automobile, steel, glass, rubber, et cetera, many of these were industries where African American men had done well, and where there's now less employment or wages are lower than they used to be. So it's been a confluence of those three different factors.
Now, also, there's what economists call occupational crowding. That is, certain women are crowded into certain occupations. Black people are crowded into certain occupations.
Right.
Certainly, you know, certain occupations are coded as for white men. Certain are coded for black women. What's happened to that kind of occupational slotting in recent years? Has that eased up, or are we still pretty rigidly slotted?
More progress in some occupations than in others. But there's still a lot of racial and gender segregation in the economy, where women and African Americans, Hispanics, tend to be crowded in jobs which pay lower than average wages, and white males tend to occupy jobs which pay higher wages. And in fact, you can almost look at the race-gender composition of the job and sort of tell whether or not that's a high-paying occupation. And one of the things that I found in my own research is that even when you control for differences in the characteristics of the worker, things like their score on a standardized test, their years of education, region, tenure on the job, et cetera, that being crowded into a job with a large fraction of women or a large fraction of African Americans will lower one's pay independently of one's so-called human capital attributes.
So what kind of occupations are we talking about? Could you give some examples?
Service occupations. I mean, even within, like, whether you're looking at service or manufacturing, even within those broad occupational groups, there's racial and gender crowding. Right? Women have done well in a lot of the service occupations that open up and tend to be. We had an increase in service occupations, and women have been occupying a lot of those, and decline in O-line manufacturing, jobs where men were heavily located. But in any of these jobs, which tend to pay much lower than average pay, you're looking at large numbers of women in particular, if they're service-related, and men, African-American, Hispanic men.
Speaking with Patrick Mason, economist, teaches at the University of South Florida, and one of the...
Slight correction.
Yes.
Florida State.
Florida State, sorry. Yes, yeah. I'm such a Yankee, you know, it's all a mystery down there to me. Florida State, sorry about that. Also, Patrick Mason is one of the leading experts on the economics of discrimination. The boom of the late 90s and into early 2000 brought at least, you know, some of the headline indicators looking pretty good. I mean, the black poverty rate hit an all-time low. But what was responsible for that? And second of all, have those gains gone up in smoke in the recession?
What was responsible for that was the pushing of the unemployment rate among African Americans to an all-time low by the end of the 90s. I mean, that is the above and beyond the issue of wage differences. I actually think access to employment is a much bigger issue. Generally speaking, the African-American unemployment rate is twice the national average. So the national average right now is like 6%, then among African-Americans is 12%. And that's why whenever you have a recession, it tends to undo a lot of the gains from previous years, and then it takes several years to catch up with those gains, and then by that time, of course, you get another recession.
Yeah, well, it looks, I mean, it doesn't look like we're going to get back to these boom times anytime soon. We may have a recovery, but I doubt it's going to be a really, really powerful one like we saw in the late 90s. So is it enough to rely on, you know, just the business cycle to solve the problems of racial income gaps, or does it require more activist government policies?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the periods when the greatest gains have been made, they're always periods when there's an activist government policy of some sort. Because especially if the issue is both, say, getting the African American unemployment rate down to the range, say, that one typically sees among whites at the peak of a boom, around 4%, 3%. That requires extensive government action, I think, in the form of job creation, especially if you want to not only get the rate down to a very low level, but sustain it for a very long period of time. I mean, if we leave the economy to its own devices, we will continue to get these periods of boom and bust, where every time you have a recession, it will undo all those gains made from previous years, and then you start back all over again trying to catch up.
So what kinds of policies are really necessary to do the trick?
Policies that are aimed at job creation, especially, if necessary, direct job creation, especially at individuals with the least amount of education and younger workers, because that's where the most difficult employment problems are. And that can be everything from, I've heard some people talk about the amount of work that we need on the national bridge system of roads, where we could have the federal government hiring people to do that. Something that's productive, useful, that teaches skills and training, and that will also utilize a large number of workers who are currently not working.
And how important are anti-discrimination and affirmative action policies?
Those policies are very important for getting both access to the better-paying jobs and making sure that there's equal pay for equal work, equal pay for work that's, you know, very similar. The anti-discrimination policies, especially in the labor market, are important, but it's not just important to get people to get equal pay for equal work, you know, equalize in terms of wages, but also to get jobs in the first place, right? And that's where I think there's a much greater difficulty. I mean, if you look at the I have a measure of what we call the non-participation rate, and that's the fraction of individuals in the working age population who are neither employed nor unemployed. They're just out of the labor force. That rate for African American men is 26%, which is only slightly lower than the non-participation rate for white women of 28%. By contrast, it's only about 15% for white men. So we've got to do something to create many, many, many more jobs.
So in other words, when you compare unemployment rates, that's actually understating the problem, because so many African Americans have just dropped out of the labor force because it's hopeless.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the unemployment rate doesn't tell the true extent of joblessness, because the unemployment rate does not take account of, for example, of people who are working part-time but who would like to work full-time. Unemployment rate just measures whether or not you have a job at all. It doesn't account for the fraction of people who just become discouraged and stop looking. They're out of the labor force, and those numbers are very high. And what happens is that as jobs begin to open up, many people who become discouraged and stop looking will now begin to become active job seekers. So sometimes it will take a while for that unemployment rate to go down, even though economic activity is picking up.
And it's not picking up fast enough right now to make a difference in the unemployment rate.
No.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Patrick Mason. And that was Patrick Mason, a professor of economics at Florida State University, an interview I first ran in this program in June of this year. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back in person next week. And let's go out with the Fugue No. 7 in A major from Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy.